First of all, good morning, everyone, and shalom. The subject is, and you can memorize this if you'd like, there is hope for a tree. Now, some of you will remember where that comes from. It's not essential, but it's an important and beautiful verse. It comes in the 14th chapter of Job, and let me just read a section from it. At least there is hope for a tree. If it's cut down, it will sprout again, and its new shoots will not fail. Its roots may grow old in the ground and its stump die in the soil. But yet, at the scent of water, it will bud and put forth shoots like a plant. But man dies and is laid low. He breathes his last and he is no more. As water disappears from the sea, or a river bed becomes parched and dry, so man lies down and does not rise. Till the heavens are no more, men will not awake or be roused from their sleep. If only you would hide me in the grave and conceal me till your anger is past. If only you would set me a time and then remember me. If a man dies, will he live again? All the days of my hard service, I would wait for my renewal to come. You would call and I would answer. This particular section is, of course, Job lamenting. Everything has been taken from Job. And we can be very critical of Job sometimes making foolish remarks. Yet we should remember that God introduces Job. There's none like him on earth. He is the Moses of his era. Blameless and upright, God calls Job. Now, I don't know anybody like Job. I think he is the example for teaching a generation, a group in an area. And that might be quite a wide group, because as we read in Job, we read about snow and ice. Often he's placed out in the desert somewhere. I don't think so. God introduces Job and tells him that he has been foolish in his remarks to criticize him, and he has. And yet there is hope in what he says, that you would remember me. So Job is what the three supposed friends, Elihu, Bildad, Zophar, as they shrink, Job actually grows. So by the time Elihu cuts in and continues to tell Job that he has made some foolish remarks and yet gives him some insight that maybe this is all in God's plan, Job does not respond to Elihu. And then the Almighty comes in and accuses Job of the same thing. And Job is quiet and says, I've been a fool to speak and I repent. At the end of the book, if Job didn't pray for the others, particularly for his three supposed friends, they would perish. It's Job's prayer that ends the book with a positive, and then of course, he's blessed with children. And he's lost 10 children, remember, instantly, one time. In the 19th chapter, and I would certainly agree, Job doesn't have any particular insight to Messiah, but he does see. And he continues what he has kind of hoped for in a vague way in the 14th chapter. and it becomes a little stronger. I know that my Redeemer lives. And then he goes on to say some interesting words. Now, what he knows about his body, and I think it's more of a hope still, but notice that he continues in the same vein in the 19th chapter, which we're all quite familiar with. It certainly occurs in the Messiah. And there he's probably just a couple of verses in the 19th, the 17th. Though I summon my servant, he does not answer. Though I beg him with my open mouth, my breath is offensive to my wife. I'm loathsome in my own brothers. Even little boys scorn me. When I appear, they ridicule me. The interesting thing is, though he feels he's dying, and he certainly feels like he's dying, he's in great pain, he asks them to have pity on him, and they don't, because they are so sure that he's done something bad, number of things he must have, to have 10 children killed, all of his animals taken away, everything destroyed, and his body riddled with pain. And he says, oh, that my words were recorded, that they were written on a scroll. They were inscribed with an iron tool on lead or engraved in a rock forever. I know that my Redeemer lives, and that in the end he will stand on the earth. He certainly is inspired, I think, when he says that, and he is absolutely correct. So after my skin has been destroyed, yet in my flesh, I will see God. I'll see him. I myself will see him, and with my own eyes, I, not another. Oh, how my heart yearns within me. And I think we can literally understand that Job is in despair, and yet he has an inkling that God will remember him. Now, the interesting thing, while there is hope for a tree, there doesn't seem to be much hope for any of humanity, according to Job, and yet we have a lemon tree outside that is flourishing. And about 3 years ago, we have a gardener comes in. In those days, he came in twice a month and mostly collected leaves, of which we have in abundance. And he said, your lemon tree's dying. Should I remove it? And we pretty well said what Jesus said, leave it alone for a year. We'll dig it about and water it. Because it's in the very corner of the garden, it doesn't directly get as much water. And now the lemon tree has revived. We did make a point of watering it a little more seriously, and it's loaded now with lemons. Trees are often very deep rooted. And I particularly think when we were in Israel and in Scotland and in Ireland, we find that they are planting whole forests. And what that has done, particularly in Israel, has increased their rain. Now, we are still in a drought, even though we had a wonderful amount of rain this morning here. And yet, trees survive. I can remember the Oakland fire, and everybody said, well, cut down the eucalyptus. They're just explosive. They're a problem. And so they did. For a great, great many of them, they cut them down. And the interesting thing is, within a couple of years, the shoots came up from the earth, and it was actually almost a return of a forest of eucalypts. You could say the same thing about all of the area in the Sierras and throughout California where we've had fires. It's amazing if you go back a few years later. It's like, you know, there has been damage. There's evidence probably for another 5 or 6 years here. We had a terrible fire in our area, as many of you know, came right to our back fence. It was 30 feet high, and the firemen stood and prevented it destroying homes. And our house in particular, just our back fence went. But in the midst of this drought and the midst of fires, they're replanting because trees provide not only oxygen, but they aerate the soil as well. In fact, trees provide nutrients that bless all of us. So after our fire, everybody said, well, it's all destroyed. And interestingly, they went around and they cut into the trees. And I would say 80% of them actually have survived. Yes, many had to be cut down. So trees are deep rooted. The vines in our area are what is called dry farm very often. Now that's a contradictory term, isn't it? How can you farm without water? We have 5 or 6 months without water in California. It's just typical of the Mediterranean cycle. And yet, we went up to a local winery, very, very nice winemaker and part owner of the property. And he took us for a little tour. And we got to an area of 5 or 6 acres. It's a beautiful area. And the vines are, 5.5 feet high, approximately, and look nice and healthy. They said, we don't water these. These are dry farm. And then he proceeded to tell us they were astonished. They went down. They were doing some digging, I guess, to see where the water table was. And they went down 30 feet, and the vines were down there. So, because of water underneath the surface, kind of an aquifer in our area, those wines, which come from dry farm grape vines, were actually flourishing. That's not the only area. We're in Hawaii, and I'll try not to go on too much, but I could go on, it seems like forever. We took a hike in what they call the jungle. Not only they call it jungle, it gets 140 inches of rain a year. It was lush and beautiful. And the little bamboo plants went up 160 feet. 160 feet. They use them to irrigate or run water sometimes. But in this area, it was just the natural water from heaven. And by the way, bamboo is the fastest growing tree in the world. It's been known to grow, I think it's 2 feet in a day. You can check me on that, but at least 2 feet in a day. And when they get up to 100 feet, they slow down slightly. The other plant that we saw when we went to a waterfall, really a rugged kind of a slope going down, a beautiful, what they call the hidden waterfall. And we looked out, and there were some plants all around us where, as the water rushed by from the fall. Now, some of the people actually climbed up the side with vines on the fall. I wasn't about to do that, but it was a good 40, 50 foot fall. And a beautiful area, and the plants by the side were flourishing, obviously because of all of the water. And so papyrus, which grows throughout the world and grows in Hawaii, had to be cut twice a week. They said, we have to come down and cut this papyrus, twice a week. It grows so fast, otherwise you wouldn't be able to see the waterfall. So in the scripture, and we're constantly aware of it, I think, the idea of trees bringing life from the time of the garden where we began, where creation began, till the time of the apocalypse and the end of that age, water is essential, important, and a blessing. We have a beautiful home 5 miles up the road in Hillsburg. Went to, again, to see it. It's called Camellia House. It's a beautiful restored Queen Anne, quite large. It was used as a hospital in World War I. And there was a tree outside, and he asked us, what do you think this is? And we all, I don't think anybody understood. Well, it's a conifer, yes. I think maybe it's some exotic fir that comes from the east. No. It's the cedar of Lebanon, which was brought over by Luther Burbank 70 years ago. It was already 150 feet high and more. Massive branches going out. And now I'll try and get back to the scripture after saying all this, but it was impressive to see in this country, and it's probably illegal now. In fact, I hope it's illegal to cut down any cedar of Lebanon and bring it over. But Luther Burbank was a famous botanist and chemist and an amazing individual. And so he brought the tree over and planted, and it's flourishing. It's amazing. And the reason I happen to mention the cedar of Lebanon, I would like you to think, because now it's time to for you to do a little cogitation and think about what tree represents Israel. Is it that cedars, or is it fig tree, olive tree, pomegranate, palm tree? Which one represents Israel? And if you'll excuse me, my answer is they all represent Israel in different texts, in different areas. I know people like to say, well, it's got to be the fig tree because Jesus cursed it at Bethphage, and it's representative of Israel's demise. Well, yes, he was using that as a symbol. But even in Luke, when it says, now listen to this parable about a fig tree and all the trees. Look at that in Luke 21 later. He's not just talking about the fig tree. He's saying when spring comes, you're aware of it. So when you see Jerusalem surrounded with armies, get out, leave. And most of the Christians did and were able to get away. So when I say what tree represents Israel, all of them, or at least four of these, are there in the most holy place. There are 30-foot planks in the most holy place, 30 feet of cedar planks. The olive tree is represented, and the cherubim are made, and the huge cherubim covering the whole area, made out of olive wood and then covered with gold. And that's in the most holy place. Pomegranates are represented on the priest's garments. They're represented in Jacinth and Boaz, the great pillars outside of the temple in the entrance to it. And the palm tree is the only tree that's represented physically on the walls in the most holy place in Ezekiel's temple. So all of the trees are representative of different aspects and different eras and different times of Israel. So what tree is Messiah represented by? I want you to think about that just for a moment. What tree represents Messiah? Is it the great cedar tree? Is it the olive tree? After all, Romans 11, the olive tree represents what? Israel, and we're grafted in. In Isaiah, in the 11th chapter, one of my favorites, unfortunately, so I've probably read from it before, but there is a beautiful remark about Messiah. You will remember it. A shoot will come from the stump of Jesse. From his roots, a branch will bear fruit. The Spirit of the Lord will rest on him, a spirit of wisdom and understanding, a spirit of counsel and of power, the spirit of knowledge and the fear of the Lord. He will delight in the fear of the Lord. He will not judge by what he sees with his eyes, decide what he hears with his ears, but with righteousness he will judge the needy and will give justice and decisions for the poor of the earth. Beautiful, I think, inspiring passage, but it begins with a branch from the stump of Jesse, or if you will, from the stump of David, from the root of David. Jeremiah says much the same thing. Says in the 33rd chapter, and I was going to turn it up, but I think I'll just leave it. He talks and says, well, there is hope with the terebinth and an oak that it will revive, and Messiah will come from that. But maybe in all of this, I misled you because we're barking up the wrong tree. Yeah. Sorry for the pun. Not terribly sorry. I wouldn't have used it, but we are barking up the wrong tree. If you turn with me, and I think we're all aware of this if we think about it, it's not as much a tree as it is a vine. In John's Gospel in the 15th chapter, we probably, again, are very familiar with this. He says, I am the vine and you are the branches. I am the true vine and my Father is the gardener. He cuts off every branch in me that bears no fruit, while every branch that does bear fruit, he prunes so that it will be even more fruitful. And sometimes we complain about the pruning, and yet we are in the hands of the Almighty. You are already clean because of the word I've spoken to you. Remain in me, and I will remain in you. That's Jesus' promise to all of us. No branch can bear fruit by itself. It must remain in me, the vine. Neither can you bear fruit unless you remain in me. So Jesus is a vine, and we say, well, that's an insignificant thing. How can we all be branches? One more story. When we were in Italy about 4 years ago, maybe five now, we went to a local vintner up on the hill of the Amalfi Coast, a beautiful area. He had a nice small farm, but grew grapes and actually bottled them, and we had some of his, which was quite good. But the point was, he went and we visited the old vineyard he has, and we saw a 300-year-old vine that I couldn't quite put my arms all the way around. that grew about 9 feet and then spread branches about 20 feet because they had to be cut. After all, he was still getting grapes 300 years later. And it impressed me with what I said earlier, that the roots go deep and the vine, when it's healthy, continues to produce fruit. That's simply, I guess, the respect I have for water and trees, life. I know a lot of people, and I can understand that, love the colors of the desert. But to me, the desert represents an area that may have once flourished. I've been through that in the West. And they said when the pioneers came through, you know, the grass was up to the horse's head. And I think that's probably true. In fact, I know it's true that a vine is a very, very productive thing. It brings forth fruit, brings forth grapes. And so Jesus, often when he's talking about bringing forth fruit, what is he actually getting at? You have to be a part of Jesus to bring forth fruit. That's a strange expression, isn't it? What kind of fruit do we bring forth? And I think we have to look at one another and realize we may not bring as much fruit as we'd like, but it's our compassion, our feeling, our understanding about what Jesus did, how he is alive and with us and helps us, that helps us to bring forth fruit, which is caring for other people, not being prejudiced against them because they look different. And that's all too common in our world today, as we know, and I think it has been throughout history. It's like a tree planted by streams of water that brings forth fruit in its season. Now, how much time do I have left? I time and I are oblivious.
20 minutes.
Oh, lots of time. Good. Because I would like to just take a look at a passage that obviously intrigues me because I've mentioned it before, but it's in Ezekiel, the 47th chapter, and you will right away remember it. In the 47th chapter of Ezekiel, we read about the water that breaks forth and waters Israel particularly, but also blesses that whole area of the Jordan Rift and of what's called the Arava, that area which becomes dry on the other side of the Dead Sea, or the south side. And yet Ezekiel talks, and let me just read these words. I think they're beautiful. He talks about measuring off this water, 1,000 feet. He led me through the water. It was up to my waist. Measured off another 1,000, but now it was a river I couldn't cross. By that, I think he means the swiftness of it, and it may have been, and it appears to be at least 100 yards across this massive flow coming out of the earth, out of the temple. Because the water had risen so deep, it was enough to swim in, a river that no one could cross. And he asked me, "Son of man, do you see this?" And then he led me to the bank of the river. And when I arrived there, I saw a great number of trees on each side of the river. He said to me, "This water flows toward the eastern region and goes down to the Arava, where it enters the sea. So it completely cleans and flushes out the salt, so the salt is removed to the banks," and he goes on to describe that. But the part I particularly want us to focus on is this wonderful living tree of life, or trees of life, I guess I'll have to say, on both sides of the river produce fruit and healing for the people. And it's true that many healing drugs and presence, just the liquid, comes from trees. I've actually witnessed that, and we tend to forget about it. We tend to think, oh, they're all manufactured out of minerals. Some are, and some are just manufactured out of junk. But trees produce life in every way. So for the pilgrims who are going up to the temple, and you've heard me say this, I guess, but I'm impressed by it. On the way, they have something to eat, because they're walking up continually up as this water rushes by. They have fresh water, and they have fruit, and the leaves are for healing. It's a wonderful concept, I think, concerning what God has planned for that whole area and for the whole earth, ultimately. We know that when water comes back, life begins. We see it in the deserts. We see it everywhere we go. When they have heavy rains, beautiful floral patterns cover the earth. So it's talking about a new life for those that go up to worship. And I think you've also heard me say that I think the waters will be high enough that they will be able to come down by boat and then walk up by this river to the temple. That's just my opinion. You can look at it and say, a little fanciful. But in the final age, after the kingdom, there is another case where trees are mentioned. And I say trees, I almost could say tree. There is hope in a tree. There are two words in the New Testament for tree, dendron and eulon, or exon. Now, it depends how you pronounce it. But I'm going to call it exlon because it's a little easier to say than zulon or something. Those two Greek words describe two kinds of trees. One, Zacchaeus climbed up and was representative in all the beautiful trees of the Garden of Gethsemane, those ancient olives. That is a tree that can bear fruit. And yet the other one, zulon, or exon, take your pick. It's not easy to say either way. Is found, for example, take a look at, if you have your Bibles, and if you don't, you can just look at it later, to the Revelation. And in the second chapter, he promises the Ephesians something remarkable, I think. He who has an ear to hear what the Spirit says to the churches, and he's now addressing church in Ephesus, to him who overcomes, I will give the right to eat from the tree of life, which is in the paradise of God. The tree of life is represented by the word which, best translation, zulon means dead tree which has been cut down and made into a staff, or in this case, a cross. When Peter addresses them and says, you killed the Messiah, when he's standing in front of the elders of the Jews, you killed Messiah and hung him on a tree. It wasn't a tree, it was a dead tree, it was a timber. And yet that is the word used here in the Apocalypse throughout it for life, for the tree of life. So we have something that was just dead wood bringing forth life. It's Christ who is being represented by the cross, who brings forth the tree of life. And it is Christ who is the tree of life. Take a look at the 22nd chapter, and I know I've read from this one before too, and I don't even apologize. I find it beautiful. The angel showed me the river of water, the water of life, as clear as crystal, flowing from the throne of God and of the Lamb down the middle of the great street of the city. On each side of the river stood, and this is singular, it's not plural, the tree of life. It's like a banyan tree. If you've ever seen a banyan tree that we'll cover frequently do in areas of the world, an acre of land. So from this one zulon, this one cross, is formed the tree of life. And at the very end of the 22nd chapter, the 19th verse, Jesus says, I will give you the tree of life. It's a complete cycle, and we shouldn't be surprised at that. The tree of life is now a dead tree, which has come to life. Let me conclude with a poem. You'll excuse me, it's brief. I'll be very brief. It's not one of Longfellow's. I think that I shall never see a poem lovely as a tree whose hungry mouth is pressed against the earth's sweet flowing breast. A tree that looks at God all day and lifts its leafy arms to pray. Poems are made by fools like me, but only God can make a tree. Poem Joyce Kilmer, who unfortunately died at a young age in the First World War. Like so many artists and poets and writers. Some look at it and say, well, that's kind of modeling. Well, I find it beautiful. Tree of life. Thank you.
Thank you, Brother John. And we have about 5 minutes or so. So I'm going to open up the path for...
Yeah, you can ask me questions. I don't have answers, but that's fun.
We can ask you questions you don't have answers to. We're not allowed to ask you questions you do have answers to.
Well, I mean, I always attempt to answer. Doesn't mean I know anything.
That's fine. We can give it a whirl. Okay, 5 minutes. If you are speaking in here, then you need to turn off the this microphone so that everyone online can hear you. I'm going to go back and switch onto the group view so that everyone can see.
Hi. You know, you have a tree out by you that can give you some, I know, spiritual lessons or not. It's the most common pine in the country. It's called a ponderosa pine.
Oh, love it. Yeah.
And to be healthy, it has to go be on fire about every 10 years.
Yeah.
And there's some that are 500 years old out there because they have to have fire.
So, oh, yeah, redwoods too. Redwoods, as you know, you've certainly seen them, are often burnt at the base and they flourish. They're amazing. Fire is part of the process. So the problems we are having nowadays is that the weeds are so high, the fires get higher, and it's causing great damage. But yeah, ponderosa is one of my favorites. It smells like vanilla. It's absolutely beautiful.
Yeah. So I said there's that little lesson. And the other interesting thing about them, of course, is they, believe it or not, don't like shade. They grow in the sunny parts of your side of your...
Right.
So there you go. they're trees that need fire, need to be fired to live and only live in the light, not in the darkness. There you go.
John?
Yes.
Yeah, this is Marco.
Yes. Hi, Marco. I can see you.
Yeah, thank you. So first of all, I want to thank you because what you were doing were connecting echoes from one place to the other in regards to trees. And I love all of the scriptures that you used, even the one that I'm actually going to talk about today.
Yeah. Oh, good, good.
In the book of Revelation, the letter to the Ephesians.
Yeah, oh, good. Yeah.
I'll make an echo connection regarding to the tree of life. But I really appreciated what you did this morning. So thank you.
Thank you very much. Yeah.
One other little anecdote for you. My Italian grandparents in living in Brooklyn grew fig trees. Now, fig trees are a Mediterranean tree. In order to make them flourish every year, they had to be bent over, covered with hay, and then dirt. And then in the springtime, you dug them back out again. So you had to put them in the ground and resurrect them.
And yeah, so I think the Italians just value fig trees because Mary's grandfather did the same thing in New Jersey. Yeah.
So there you go. There's another example of something because figs are in the Bible all over the place. But
we have a fig tree and I love it. And I could say it represents Israel, but so does the olive and so does the palm. And so, yeah, yeah.
When you read about the vineyard and the sower there and the results of what that the fruitful vine will do, that does represent Christ.
Yeah, the vineyard. There's a vineyard song. It's in Isaiah, is it?
Yes. Yeah. Yeah. Fifth chapter. It there are several actually. There's one on the Psalms as well. Yeah.
There you go. That's you got the Bible's written at a time when people were much more connected to natural things.
Yes.
You couldn't survive in an agricultural society without paying close attention.
Getting your hands dirty. Yeah.